Hey, we are back. We're doing another episode of Trail Talk. Today, we're out here with Lane 4 of Voodoo. Four like the number four, but not spelled that way, is how I figured out how to pronounce it. He built some of the best cages for side-by-sides. We're actually in a machine that has his cages on it, or his cage on it. As always, thanks to Cardo for communications, and thanks to Onyx for tracking. You can follow along with us wherever we're going. But anyways, Lane, thanks for coming out, man.
Absolutely.
It's been a long time coming. I've been trying to get you out here for a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say the traveling makes it rough. You say, between deliveries and fun, I'm out of town most of the time.
Yeah, do you deliver, well, let's just jump right into it. Do you deliver nationwide and do you run them yourself?
That one, yes and no. So, like, okay. Back east to a certain extent, like, the furthest I've gone is Missouri. Okay. And at that point, it gets very difficult to justify sales that way just because of how much time and money it costs to get them there.
Okay.
The East Coast seems to be, and I could be very wrong, it's just my opinion from what I've dealt with, but it seems to be kind of behind in times. Like, if I go out, yeah, like, I cold call a lot. Like, people don't think about that in the side-by-side industry. I don't think a lot. Like, they just think, oh, Voodoo builds roll cages. It's like, no, I got to tell people I do.
Yeah, you have to market yourself.
Right. So I call back east, and I'll talk to those guys. And, like, one of the more common things you'll hear is, you know, hey, we build roll cages. You know, if you bulk order, yes, we can ship them to you. You'll have to pay for shipping, blah, blah, blah. This is still good, right?
Yeah, they're still going that.
Okay.
It's all good. GoPro camera just went black.
So I don't know. Okay. So either way, you'll hear a lot of the whole, well, yeah, we offer cages, we sell pro armor. And it's like, oh, no, I don't want to explain this one because, I mean, they still follow the same guidelines as what, like, a stock cage does. So.
Okay.
I can go into depth in that if you want, but I'll finish the driving thing. So I've gone everywhere from Seattle, Washington, obviously, like, Texas, California, Phoenix, Missouri. We've shipped them overseas, but then again, that shipping. But I do a lot of the driving because I can still handle the phone calls. I can pretty much do 90% of my work from my phone. So to me, it's always been very important to get the product out there and push the name more so, because a lot of people give me, from a business standpoint, they give me a little bit of grief over the fact that I don't charge to ship stuff. And I'm like, okay, but I'd rather have 20 cages in this state to get the name out there, to get the brand recognition, you know, let people see what we have. I'll use my time and my fuel, you know, or pay for fuel to get that stuff there.
Yeah, now, you know what people can see? Cages. You know what they can't see? Shipping. So you might as well have the money in something that's recognizable.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I bet I normally am in, I'd say, a minimum of 3 different states a month.
Okay. So that's covered your shipping. We kind of skipped ahead there. What's your, how did Lane 4 get into, like, you know what? These side-by-sides, they have these cages. They're kind of wet noodles. I'm just going to start building them. How did you get into doing this?
That's a long story, but short story would be I grew up in North Carolina. I don't want to skip that part because a lot of people think I'm from Wyoming. I'm not from Wyoming.
I can hear it a little in your voice. It's not a Wyoming accent. Yeah.
I've lived in a lot of states now, so I don't know what my accent is anymore, but
either way. It's a good blend.
Yeah. So I worked up there from 19 to 25, 26. I can't remember exactly when I left. But either way, it was during the time of working there, it seemed like it was all for nothing. I saved a lot of money. I had no help starting. I saved up, you know, a lot over a few years, paid off all my debt. I knew I wanted to do something. I didn't even know it was roll cages at the time. So
you're talking about in Wyoming, you started a business or
nope. Didn't start there.
You were just working there.
Right. This is just the mindset going into it. So
okay.
didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew, well, whatever you want to do to start, you're going to need money and you're going to, you know, you're going to need a lot of knowledge and money to start. So either way, I ended up quitting there and going and taking a job in Nevada because I heard there was sand dunes close. I love sand dunes. That's what I started with.
Okay.
So I moved there to find out, for one, the job that I got hired for, I no longer had.
So oh, no.
It went from, I'd been in management for 3 years up there, 3 or 4 years. And then I showed up and it was, hey, sorry, I know you got this position, but we gave it to a guy who's been here longer. And I'm like,
cool, cool.
Awesome. Thanks. They're like, are you okay with being a mechanic welder again? I'm like, yeah, I know how to do it. Like, not a problem. But I'm like,
you're like, well, since I already moved here.
Right. I'm like, what do I do now? Like, call my old job back, be like, ah, they screwed me. So I moved. I think it was over 12 hours, but I moved to get a job I didn't apply for and take a pay cut.
Right. Perfect.
So it didn't last very long because it wasn't necessarily about the work I had to do. The facilities and the company was just kind of behind in times 20 years okay. from what I came from, but it's what I needed. I was looking for a job to take that would make me uncomfortable to where I'm not leaving a high paying cushy office job yeah. to go start a business and maybe go broke.
Something to put a little hunger in you kind of thing.
Exactly. 1,000%.
Right.
So at that point, I'm like, well, I got to decide what to do. And I'm like, so far, the only thing I've thought about is I have a Turbo S Razor and it, around that time when they first came out, they had so many recalls on the cage. They put a stop sale on them.
Oh, really? So similar to like the fuel pump where they had a stop sale
yep.
for the cage itself?
Right. So, which is kind of weird now to think about. I don't know if I knew it at the time because I wasn't that familiar with cages. But it's the same cage on an XPT, like the 64 inches, as it is on a
yeah.
Turbo S. Well, in my head, new car, different product. Not the case, but that's what I thought. So I had looked at, you know, the competition, TMW, RSK, Vent Racing, and
mm-hmm.
I did not like any of their products. Like, I've bought from them in the past before I started my own, but I was just like, kind of feel like none of them have a look that I want to go for. Like, I really love this about this guy's cage. I really like this about that guy's, but I'm like, I'd never bent tube either. I'll tell you that. I'd never bent a tube in my life.
Really?
No, it wasn't like I came in this with like, oh, you know, it was my side gig. I built 10 of them, you know, but now like, I think I want to try and make it a full-time gig. It was just like, it's been a tube. How hard can it be?
Yeah, it's just a pipe. It's going this way. It just needs to go that way.
Turns out it's hard. But either way, so I quit, came down to St. George, didn't know anybody. I stayed at the Desert Garden Inn for like a month.
Okay, so, yeah, over there off Bluff.
Yeah, I think they're like remodeling it or something's going on over there because it's kind of been closed down for a while, but they're super good to me. They charged me like a discounted rate since I was staying there for right. a while, so I think it was like $45 a night, which after
hotel,
COVID,
not terrible. Yeah,
yeah, after COVID, dude, it's hard to find one under 200, so I was happy. Either way, took forever to find a shop. Turns out in St. George, if you're looking to get a shop, almost every area where there's shops, there's signs that say like they have stuff for lease. Total BS.
Okay.
They want a list of people to fill units when they become available. So they're looking
right.
for.
You're just part of their prospecting for upcoming stuff.
Yep. So found a building that wasn't finished being built, and it's still the building we're in to this day. And they're okay. like, yeah, it's going to be a month or two before you can move in or whatever. So, you know, I put my down payment on it, all that. And I'm like, well, shit, I quit my job. Like, I have to start figuring this out because the minute I move into the shop, I got to start paying rent, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. All of a sudden the bills hit.
Right. So I hit up, you know, bought a welder, hit up Bailey, went and drove all the way to, I believe it's Milwaukee where they're at. Drove like 20 some hours overnight, went, picked up the stuff. Drove back to Wyoming where I lived because I had friends who had like shops in their backyard. I'm like, right. dude, I just need to somewhere to work for now. So went up there, started building them. And yeah, after a little while, they gave me a call and were like, hey, it's ready to move in. So I packed my stuff up and was gone the next day. So
very nice.
It was probably one of the least thought out business plans of anyone. I just figured if you want it bad enough and work hard and have some capital to start, you can figure it out.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'd recommend it completely, but I will say I've tried to start quite a few little things since I've moved here, and Voodoo's got a little more stable to where I can pull some money away and try and do other things. And I'll just tell people flat out, like, if it's not your 100% focus, it's pretty much impossible. Like, I see the stuff about, like, you know, oh, start your side hustle. Once it gets to the point, it can do this.
Oh, yeah,
then
dude.
Quit your job. I'm like, no, quit your job and have no choice other than to make it work.
Like, jump off the diving board and sink or swim, man.
Like, that's what it was.
That's awesome.
It wasn't, no, well, you know, if I can sell 2 cages a month, I'll think about quit my job. It was, I have to make this work.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm moving all my crap back to Wyoming to work in the mine again. And I'm like, that's not okay in my head. Like, not an option.
Right on.
So
you got that business, you got it going, you jumped in, you had no like backup essentially. It was either that or, like you say, go back to the mine.
Right.
At what point did you feel like you're like, all right, I've hit the point where, like, this is sustainable. Actually, before we even hit that, I kind of want to circle back, because you're saying, like, oh, you're doing all this cold calling, trying to get people to buy your stuff.
Yeah.
Are you selling mostly to dealerships, individuals? Like, what does that breakdown look like? Or do you have an idea?
It's probably over 70% to dealers.
Okay.
Which we have tried to push that hard. I don't want to give a whole lot of secrets away to people that
No, you're totally fine too. I understand. So whatever you don't want to say, I'm happy to not hear it, if that makes sense.
No, I'm not afraid to talk to it, but I'll just say, in business, relationships are better than chasing the dollar, and that is
right.
What I've gone after is I want to work with someone who believes in my product. I believe in them to market it. And therefore, for every... I'm going down that path anyway.
It's all good. Oh, we could just say, is it different when you sell to, like, a dealership and you sell in bulk? Or versus, like, so for me, for this cage right here that we're in, I called you guys up. I was like, look, I'm tall. I'm going to have to sit in the back seat. Can we add 8 inches to it? Do you have any dealerships that do anything like that where they're like, we want it to look like this? Or do you just kind of say, like, this is what we have, and they're like, sweet, we love that?
Mostly it is only production. And
okay.
I will tell that if you start a company to do cages and you think custom's the path because you can charge a little bit more, you will go out of business 1,000%. I was lucky enough for a guy that owns a company in Vegas that used to build roll cages. When he met me and I was a few months deep, like, he pounded that into my head. Like, don't get me wrong, I may have started on my own and done it with my own money, but, like, the knowledge I gained from talking to other business owners and people in the industry is 1,000% why it's been successful. I don't have all these ideas myself. I'm using people who've been in business for 20 years as knowledge. So, like, for example, what you're saying, I don't mention these companies' names because we have an agreement, but we private label cages. So there's cages that come out of our shop that don't look like a Voodoo product. They don't have the, you know, emblems, the name, nothing associated with it.
Uh-huh.
But we'll deal with people who are like, you know, I will buy this many, I sell this many a month, blah, 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 but I'm looking for this amount of head height. I want, you know, kind of this style, and we'll work with them to build them basically their own unique product.
Okay. That's really cool. I didn't know that at all. I thought everything that came out of your doors was Voodoo branded or off camber branded.
Right. Which for, like, towards the start with them, I can't really remember now if it was marketed as we built it for them or if they just marketed it as their own, which I was fine with either way. They did an outstanding job. Working with off-camber was great. Like, I will forever feel like I owe them a little bit. Like, their YouTube channel, back when they were going super strong a couple years back, mm-hmm. like, they pushed a lot of our product. They're very good. I've worked with a lot of companies since where, like, I'm literally messaging the owner of the company or the, you know, the guy that runs the influence pages. And I'm like, yo, like, we gave you free product and you've mentioned us one time. Like, that's not a relationship, that doesn't work that way. No, I'm like, that's not a relationship. That was, you used your name and influence to grab something from me and it's not worth your time anymore because you already got the product. So that's been a difficult one to kind of navigate when going to, I mean, you got to understand, we get pounded by people getting into racing, people getting into the social media stuff, YouTube channels, you know, newer shops that just started up. Like, since this is a newer industry, obviously there's been a lot of room for growth. Like, hidden thing, like, kind of to look back, when I started the business, it was right when COVID hit. Everybody thought I was an idiot for starting a business during that.
Right.
Turns out that was the best time I could have done it. So yeah, it's, I mean, I'll tell this, I assume most people know by now, but like, if you have a business and you're looking at social media influencers, you've got to really do your work. Like, when I first started, I went down the path with a couple people to find out, like, oh yeah, they got 30,000 followers on Instagram and they're all fake.
Oh, and yeah. And they've paid for all of them.
Yep. Yeah. They're all fake. They're all just bots. Like, you thought you were going to get exposed to 20,000, you know, faces, and instead you probably got 100 side-by-side guys and there's 700 people that follow them. Like,
yeah,
that I've literally had a dude, I guess I won't say what he's on because I don't know how easy it is to track back, but like, I've had TV show people call me, like, you know, hey, I've got, you know, million people on Instagram, I've got, you know,
yeah, just pitching themselves as, like,
right, 20,000 subscribers on YouTube, like, this and that. And then you start looking into it and it's like, okay, like, sounds awesome. You have 20,000 subscribers, but it's like, none of your content has to do with off-road. Like, if I'm sponsoring you and 19,000 out of 20,000 of your subscribers live in New York where they don't even own a car, that doesn't do us any good.
No, so, like, selling kitchen knives. Like, yeah, it's just, the market isn't there for it, for your audience.
So, not that it necessarily maybe makes you an asshole or whatever, but like, vetting people who we want to take care of because, you know, the relationship works in both favors has become quite a tedious job. It's not just, oh, he's got 5,000 followers, he's at the dunes every weekend, let's, you know, sponsor him 30% off or whatever the number is.
Yeah. So from the other perspective, I'm obviously very small in this space, but I try to always come to it. If, like, I approach a company, my instinct is to understand that I am ad spent, essentially. Right. So, and for that, it's just like anything else, right? Like, what are you getting? What's your ROI on that ad spend?
1,000%.
There's some companies right now that they've been like, hey, we should work with you for this, that, or the other thing. And I'll be honest with you, I've had experience in the past with other companies where I'm like, I thought I could make this work, but I don't know how to, like, consistently create content around your product. And right. So this other company's approaching me and I'm like, I'm trying to figure it out, but I don't think I can consistently push what you want. Like, there's only so much I can say about XYZ thing.
1,000%. Yeah.
And it makes it kind of difficult because you want to be the person that's like, oh yeah, I got that thing now. I'm working with these guys. I'm doing this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, like you say, it has to work both ways. And it's, if you don't get it right, it can sour relationships.
Oh, very quickly. That's kind of been my thing with most of the people we work with, is I'm always like, look, when we do this for you, and because a lot of times, you know, I don't know how to put it in an exact spot, but, you know, say you're a dealership, you need light bar tabs for a car that you built in the showroom.
Uh-huh.
They want a Baja light bar. Like, a lot of times, I'm not saying every time, so my vendors don't get mad, but a lot of times we just send them to you and they're like, oh, well, we'll pay for it. No, I don't care. Like, okay. My thing is, I want you to make money, because the more you push my product, the more money you make selling my product, the better you'll advertise it, the more effort you'll put into your team of why we sell this product. So it's a very two-way thing. The guy going into business thinking, well, if I don't make $2,000 off this one sale, it ain't worth my time. It's like, no, look at it over a year. If you sell, 100 cages of mine, you're going to make a lot of money.
Yep. And what's sorry, you keep going.
No, that's good.
I was gonna say, we touched on a lot of the business side, but like, I'm curious about like the actual like construction and like, I mean, how many did you have, any prototypes? Did you roll a couple cages and go, ooh, that's not gonna work, we need more gusseting here? How did you get to the point where people like BJ and Parley and them could just go thrash these things in the rocks? Because let's be honest, they hold up really well, but I'm sure that there was maybe some learning curve going on there in the beginning.
A lot of the stuff I did in mining had to do with structure, so my mind was already shaped in that direction. A lot of it, though, I can say this full transparency now, when we started, we were the guys known for... And if somebody else out there was too, I don't know. I'm not putting you down, but we were the 120 wall company.
Right.
I mean, when back in the day of, Razor XPT or car weighed, can't remember off the top of my head now, but 1600 pounds, your top speed's what, maybe 80?
Yeah.
So we're dealing with light cars, not as high of speeds. The suspension couldn't keep up. To do what we do, like, you can bomb this thing through the whoops at, what, 70?
Yeah.
If you wanted. Like, an XPT, you wouldn't have done that because it would have beat the crap out of you.
No, it's the machine wasn't even capable of doing that.
Right. Other than the guys that are like, oh, I've got HCR and King Shocks, and they've spent 10 grand on making their suspension work.
Yeah.
So part of it was, for one, I realized on the side of metal, it's way easier to weld thicker metal.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Welding thin stuff is super hard.
Right. And it wasn't necessarily that I wasn't good enough at it, but I'm like, at a certain thickness, like, it almost, to me, it'd be better to TIG weld. I can control my heat better. But it just was so time consuming. I'm like, I can't make money doing this. If I'm selling them TIG welded, it's going to take freaking forever.
Yeah, it goes back to that custom versus production type of thing. You have to be, like, it has to be something... Not that you're like not putting in the effort to it or anything, but it has to be something that you can put into a production fashion and be able to make a significant amount of them in a short amount of time. Sorry, the drone's battery's dying, everybody. So I'm landing it while we're still talking.
Yeah, all good.
But so you worked in the mine. You did a lot of structural welding beforehand then, you said, and that kind of carried over?
I won't say I did a lot of the structural welding there. I mean, I did enough, but I got into management at 23.
Okay.
And I had anywhere from, I don't know, I'd say on a low end, 6 welders a shift, maybe up to closer to 20 during a big shift, like middle of the week day shift. So my thing was, I constantly was dealing with failure. So, yes, you might weld every day and you might be the one fixing the failure, but I was seeing anywhere from, 1, 2 to 10 failures structurally a day, and working with the welders on, okay, so if we make this stronger, what are we making weaker? Where are we pushing the failure point to? Right. So being in that headspace with welders constantly, it gave me a lot of knowledge I didn't realize was going to pay off later. I might not have been the guy that, after we came up with the game plan on how to fix this, I wasn't the dude that pounded wire for 3 shifts, but I also was the guy checking up on it multiple times through the shift. I was the guy helping come up with the plan on how to fix it. But that was one of the things that, I guess through a lot of books I had read and whatever, I understood pretty quickly going into that was, I don't have this knowledge. I'm freaking young. Like, I don't have 20 years of welding experience.
Right.
But I got four guys who work with me who do. So say I've got a newer welder who's worked for us for a year and he's coming up to me, hey man, I don't know what to do to fix this. And it's like, all right, so I'm going to go grab these two guys who've been welding for 20 years. Let's put our heads together for 5 minutes, come up with a game plan.
Yeah.
So half of it was never even me doing the talking. It was bringing these older guys that had a lot of experience into the picture going, what do you think we should do on XYZ? Well, I think we should do this and that. Okay, well, what do you think about this? Is this going to cause a problem? Nope, because of this and that. All right, sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Oh, just do what he said? Yeah, you heard him. He's got 20 years of experience. I trust his opinion.
Yeah.
So going through that scenario for years on end, obviously I got to the point where I did have a lot of those answers, but you're just problem solving, and problem solving is the best skill any person can have in life.
Right.
Is to where... not necessarily you don't ask questions, but you're not afraid to ask the questions that are important. Like, you want to think things through for yourself, but you also want to understand why people come to the conclusion. Like, if I just come to you and I go, hey, what did you bend that side frame to? And you go, 45. Okay, you know the answer, but how did I come to the conclusion?
Yeah. It's kind of like check your work in school, right? Like,
right.
How are you there? And give me the reasoning.
Right. And so, I mean, like, I'll give some of the guys credit that have helped me even in within the industry, like Vern with RSK. They're up in Salt Lake.
Yep.
I don't know that I've done a whole lot to help him. I've tried to give him ideas here and there on stuff we've done, but he's helped me a lot. Like, when I'd call him, I mean, when you talk to both of us on a personal basis, like, I've had people who talk to me about buying my product and go a different route. Like, yeah. At the end of the day, if you come to me, you want a roll cage on your car, you maybe don't like my look, maybe you don't like my style. At the end of the day, I want you to buy a roll cage.
Yeah. It's pretty important. I learned that.
I don't necessarily have to have everybody's freaking, you know, business. But I'm like, if the other guy's cheaper and, you know, most everybody in the industry, I'd recommend at this point. Most of them have gotten to the understanding of the cars are heavy. We don't cheap out on material. Things need more gusseting than they used to. We all know what we need for head clearance. We all understand this is the weakest part of the cage.
Right.
No, pretty much anyone's stuff you're buying is better than stock. And whether you're being an idiot in the sand or on the rocks or, you know, you're driving through the woods on a trail and you don't have an intrusion bar on your stock car, like, I want you to have a cage. I don't enjoy seeing life flight. So
I think that that's something that a lot of people, okay, if you're around it long enough, you will come to the conclusion that the stock cages are made out of basically bubble gum.
Yeah.
But when you initially buy a side-by-side, you're like, oh, sweet. You got these 2-inch roll bars. Everything's great. And I'm kind of ashamed to admit it, but it took me putting this on its roof to realize, yeah, that's not going to cut it.
No.
So, and that's what, obviously, I called you guys up. We had this built. We got thrown on, and it's ready to roll. But I think that, like you say, it's more important to have that safety aspect. And whatever you're doing, if you have a side-by-side, like you say, this car, I've run it across the scales. It's 2,500 pounds. It's not just a little go-kart anymore. They can severely injure you if you get upside down and, you know, come down with any amount of force. The factory cage isn't going to hang. It's just not. So it's kind of cool to see, you know, from your managerial perspective of, like, I don't know the exact answers on, like, how to throw together the welds. But at the end of the day, even in your job in the mine, right, like, the failures come back to you.
Right.
It's your product. It's your process. It's that. It's not just like, oh, being able to throw a sick bead. It's also the management of the risk, and everything comes back to whoever's running that organization or that shift or whatever. So it's good to see that, you know, you take pride and you defer to people who know.
Right.
As far as, like, the structural integrity of the metal, how it's going to work.
But yeah, exactly. And back to where we were going, with it, just to give you a little bit more about what you asked on the how did you learn.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the guys that still trust my product, it literally was as dumb as, well, I built this cage. I trust what I did. I better go show people I trust it. Because if I tell you, you can roll in your cage and you'll be fine, and I won't roll my car, why should you believe me?
Yeah.
It's kind of dumb, but I got to the point where I was rolling a car all the time, which I don't do very much anymore. It gets expensive.
But yeah, that's not fun.
Between like the Pro R I got, like beginning of 2022, it had the same cage on it forever. I finally went to put a taller cage on it. So I took it off after the car had been wrecked. I can't remember, 5 or 6 times. Two of the rolls were over 50 miles an hour, but the cage was perfectly fine. Yeah, which the bad rolls were in sand, which is a little more forgiving.
Yep.
Because it'll obviously press into that sand versus like rock, where it's just, it's normally going to flatten a tube a little bit if you wreck hard on rock.
Yeah.
But then again, like we've had issues too with now is like, okay, we've seen so many people roll cars. We'll get customers to where, I don't want to be too specific to where if they see this, they'll think I'm calling them out, but they'll be like, hey man, like I rolled my car, like the cage bent, like what the hell? And I'm like, okay, like how fast are you going? And they'll try and downplay it. And I'm like, look, at the end of the day, I don't claim we warranty cages.
Right.
Because everything's a case by case. I don't want to promote people lying to me about what happened in their car. I want to know. So I'm like, I would rather you tell me, yo, I watered it up at 70 miles an hour. It held up, but I need a new one. Can you help me out since I'm buying another one from you? Of course.
Yeah.
Because I want to know the true story behind it. It's going to benefit my company and my customers better knowing how our product holds up than the whole, oh, well, you know, I wasn't really going that fast and I'm kind of disappointed that it bent. And it's like, you've got to realize I've seen hundreds of these. So when you tell me I'm doing this low speed and you're not sure why the cage, you know, bent an inch or two in the front, I'm like, then you got me questioning my whole operation.
Well, it goes back to that, it's just the same thing we've been talking about. Like, okay, you can't get better if you don't know how it went wrong.
Correct.
Right? Like, yeah. You have to know, oh, so we have a flaw here, or we have something, maybe not a flaw, but something we can improve based on your experience. Don't right. just BS me. Like, let's hear what actually happened.
Right. Yeah. I'm like, I'll take care of you the same way at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Like, don't lie to me to try and think you're going to get a better deal out of me. Like, you ran my product. You trusted it. It did its job. Now let's get you in a new one. Right. Now, that being said, and you already hit on it a little bit, but like you're saying, and I assume when you weighed your car, that was like dry weight, nobody in it.
Yeah, that was nobody in it. That was 2,500 pounds on the nose, cat scales down at my dad's place. Now, granted, that was with your cage in it. So there's probably an extra couple hundred pounds there over the weight of the factory cage. I'm not sure. I'm assuming. No, you guys are lighter?
No.
Oh, no. I thought they were heavier.
No. They are for the most part. On a Pro R, they are actually about the same. On a Turbo R, ours is a little heavier, but I'm talking, I need to get them on a scale just to know for sure. But like a 2-seat cage of ours, and a Kawasaki is one of the longer, wider cages, so it's one of the heavier ones. Like on a 2-seat Kawasaki, you're talking 106 pounds.
Okay. Really? The factory or you?
Mine.
Yours. Okay.
Which there's probably stock. They're freaking horribly built. I've seen them take decent beatings on, you know, a single roll, but I doubt they weigh 70 pounds.
That's kind of wild to think about a car, because I don't know what the Kawasaki weighs, but I'm assuming it's close to that 2 grand mark, give or take.
Right.
And you're like, hey, guess what? All of this has to be supported by this 70-pound piece of metal if you go upside down.
1,000%. So either way, they weigh a lot. They're faster. They handle, you know, they handle so good now they almost give you false confidence.
Oh, they 100% do. It's kind of terrifying to see somebody who hasn't put one on their lid before drive, and you're like, yeah, so you don't know what happens, like, just a few clicks above what you're doing.
Right. Because that's the thing. Like, we get that all the time. People call us, well, I don't really care. Like, I'm not going to roll it. I just want it to look better. And I'm like, yeah, because all of us plan on wadding our car up and having $10,000 worth of damage.
Yeah.
Like, just because most of us aren't extremely scared of rolling, you know, people who've rolled a couple times kind of get to the point where they're like, got seats, got harnesses, cage, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
I'm like, it still costs you a lot of money.
I do think, though, I think everybody should roll one. I think
of
you
course.
Should.
Of course.
Just to get the, like, even if it just gets the jitters out of your system or whatever, or just to kind of know that there is that limit there.
1,000%. I mean, I haven't rolled a car hard, and I think the last time was when Mike Dobbs finished my All Red Pro R. That one found a witch's eye, and that was it was a dead stop into a front flip, like blew the whole front end out.
Yeah.
And since then, I'm like, I've definitely got a little more nervous on pushing it, because like I got to the point where I was rolling cars so much, I'm like, no, it's just a Saturday.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to take them out. We're going to find the limit and wreck it. And then it got to the point where I'm like, well, I'm tired of spending money on this. Like, I know my stuff holds up. Now I've got other people who trust it. They prove it holds up. So I kind of backed off being the test dummy.
Yeah.
But like you were saying, is to me in my head, I'm like, I don't want to die, but I'm like, I trust my product. I trust the weld, the tubes, how we structure them. I'm going to have to go out here and roll them to show people you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you can send your stuff off to an engineer. You can have the smartest welders and fabricators in the world, but it's like, how does it hold up in the real world?
Yeah. When metal meets rock, right. What actually happens?
Right.
I also want to talk to you about like kind of your styling. So I noticed that back east, you say back east, they're a little bit behind or whatever, but one thing that I find interesting, for the record, I don't think I've ever come down this. We might be backing up. It doesn't look too bad, but just saying, I've never been down this exact spot.
Might as well roll it. We're on camera.
Yeah. We'll show you how to test it right now.
Hell yeah.
What goes into your styling? Like, do you get a say in like how cages are designed? Obviously, a lot of it is based off of, you know, what you're working with, because it has to bolt up to the factory, like bungs and things. But do you, like, say a new car comes out, like the Pro Series come out, so you get the Pro XP, Pro R, Turbo R. You look at it and you go, okay, this has these features. It looks kind of like this. This is my style. I like the low slung back end. How do you take it from like new cars release to this is the product we're offering for that car?
Well, to kind of make sure people understand, because I probably put this kind of in the wrong perspective, I don't build them now. I was the only one doing it at first.
Right, but I'm assuming you still have some influence on the design. Or
I pretty much do all the design still.
Okay, perfect.
Yep. So it's got to the point where now I've got two really good guys that help with design. So a lot of times now it's, hey, I'm thinking like, you know, what we did on this car, when we did this custom cage, when we did this, this is the look I'm going for. And a lot of times still, I'm bending up a side frame. And at this point, I'll say part of it's not necessarily lack of confidence in my guys, because they're getting really good at it, but it's more so I don't want to lose it.
Okay, you're just clinging on to it. You're like, this
yeah,
is my baby.
I'm like, I don't want to lose it, because like, don't get me wrong, if I had to go build one of my roll cages right now, I'd have to read our whole book of notes. like back in the day, I had everything memorized. Like, I knew from, you know, the weld at the front bung to the top crossbar what the distance was. I knew, you know, say the first bend's 48 degrees, the second bend's 30 degrees with 27 degrees rotation. Like, I knew it all off the top of my head. But obviously, as you grow and you get more employees, you get to a point where you're like, okay, I've got 7,000 things on my plate, and building a cage just so I stay really good and efficient at it is holding the business back.
Right.
So, but with style, I'll say part of it. So style-wise, I won't say the East Coast is behind us. They just have a totally different style.
Right.
So to give them full credit back East, it almost seems like those two worlds like don't even seem to be together on social media to a certain degree.
No. Well, and the reason I was bringing it up with style is like, on the East Coast, you see a lot of like, I'll just say, like, Mad Ram has a huge influence on the way they build stuff. Like, their cages are tied into the bumpers in the front and rear. Like, it just seems like they are, for lack of a better term, slapping more metal on it. And talking with Chris Gatlin from Skinny Pedal Addicts, he was saying it's mostly because, like, wheel speed is huge for them out there. Like, they don't have the grippy traction we have.
Right.
So it's just that style contrast is obviously driven a little bit by necessity based on the terrain. But your guys' stuff, maybe I'm just a fanboy, but it, like, looks better than most anything I've seen, especially stuff coming from back east with all the tie-ins and things like that.
Right. And so, just to give it, like, a little more in depth, like, so a desert style cage, which essentially was the direction yours went.
Yeah, this is your desert
it
style
is
with some
1,000% not my style.
Okay.
Which I've come to learn to like it, but realistically, it was more out of necessity of, for one, like, Mike Dobbs, we did a lot with him starting out, and he's very much into that desert look. And he's like, hey, like, I kind of want to work with you on building something that I want to sell and that you can offer so you have something else. And so, dude, for, like, I don't know what it went on, maybe a week or two, but I'm just building cages, and every day he's coming over to the shop at the end of the day. I'm like, what do you think of this? And he's like, I don't like this. Okay, then, well, what do I do? Like, it's really hard to build stuff at a standpoint of, like, I don't know, what's a car you think is ugly?
Yeah.
Like, okay, now build, so, like, okay, say you think, I don't know, I'm just gonna throw something out there random, like a Kia Soul, you think it's ugly, but say you work for Mercedes and they're like, we need a car that we can sell to that type of customer. You're gonna be like, I don't want to be the one in charge of designing this. I think they look horrible.
Yeah, you're like, I don't like this. I would never buy one.
Yeah, so either way, through working through it with Mike, I got to put enough of the stuff that I appreciate and see that maybe not everybody does because they don't build them. It was give and take from my end, but almost, I don't want to say ultimately, but Mike pushed that very hard on us and kind of made me be better, because if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have done it.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, so I'm
your style is more that fastback style.
Of course.
That's what you like. Okay.
Yep. So, then on top of that, one of the problems I started to see with my own cars and whatnot is riding sand dunes. And a lot of people think they drive fast, I've learned, because then I'll take them out on rides and I learned that they don't drive fast at all. But
and they're white knuckled the whole time and you're like,
yeah, exactly.
What are you doing, man? I thought you were fast.
Which I don't care, but I'm like, you've got to understand, you have to be at a very fast speed for this stuff to start mattering a lot. So, for one, if you're in the sand dunes, for one, constantly going over humps. So, what are you trying to see? Over your dash, over the crossbar.
Yep.
So, that becomes an issue. When you're going down a hill and you're looking into the next hill, or say you're in a bowl and you're trying to look out your window or out the front, you're trying to see stuff before you get there so you can make a decision leading the group. Now, if you're second, third, fourth in line and you're staying on, you know, the leader's ass, probably doesn't matter. But I was always that guy up front back in the day. And having a view out the front, to me, I'm such a stickler on, like, if you look at my cars, I don't run mirrors. I don't run mirrors there. Okay. I don't run mirrors there. I don't run windshields. I do nothing, because this little gap right here, when I'm doing 70 around a bowl and I'm trying to check for an out, I don't have time to turn my head over here. Like, I got to know I'm going that way.
So you're all from a functionality perspective of, like, I got to make 1,000%. These snap decisions, and I don't want anything to obstruct my ability to do that.
Yep. So, like, we get away with it in the rocks, because it's like, okay, if you're wanting to hit some wall you've never hit before, you're probably going to approach it, put your wheels up on it a couple times, kind of try and get...
I'm doing 3 miles an hour right now.
You've got time, but, like, in the sand dunes, you've got... Sometimes you have less than a second of somebody hopping over the top of a dune as you're trying to come out of it, and it is your decision whether you're going over the top, going to the bottom, because you can't just slam your brakes on a hill like this.
No, you got to keep your momentum, keep yourself planted
and
into the sand.
You want, yeah, right. And you want to give the people behind you the best chance of not having a head on, not rolling over the top, not slamming their brakes and barrel rolling to the bottom. So you have so much responsibility and decisions to make so fast. A lot of my issue, because in my personal style, I love the front end being low.
Okay.
Like, the more radius I can put in a cage, the further I can drop this down, I think it looks very supercar-ish.
Yeah.
Like, you look at a Porsche, you look at a Bugatti, they're almost like a hood and just a round line over it.
Yeah, just kind of like that Ford GT look with just the really sloped and then, yeah, or the really low profile and then just that little bubble out the top.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, like, if I could achieve that exact look, I would, but functionality-wise, it's terrible.
Yeah.
So that's where kind of having the taller front ends, like, I don't mind the look either. I'd say if I could improve on it, I would, but it would take away from functionality.
Right.
So then you get back into the whole problem of, okay, the further we bring the crossbar back so you have more view out the top versus this being, if it was bent more forward, that bar would be essentially there in your vision.
Yeah, I'm tall and I'd be like out right here to hold on to the handle.
So the more you want to bring that bend back, the weaker the cage gets.
Okay, is that just because that angle straightens out?
Yep. Like, if you look at, like, I'll bring him up again, like, RSK, like, his cages, I don't know if I'll say this on the pros, because I pay attention, I don't pay attention like I used to when I was his consumer. But, like, on his Turbo S's, they're very boxy. And yeah, I dig the style. I think it looks sick. But it's more structural, but you lose a lot of view.
Right. Because you're pushing that bar out, and it necessarily comes down in your vision.
Right. And I think on his pros, it's a little bit different, but it's basically just, it's pushed the whole thing of, like you're saying, is we're buying almost a trophy truck.
Right.
Like, okay, we're not doing 140 through whoops.
Don't say that to the trophy truck people. They'll correct fast. No, you guys and your little golf carts aren't even anywhere close.
Okay, I'll put it this way. The average guy's skill level in a trophy truck versus the capability of his truck, those parameters are so much closer than the first time buyer in the side-by-side world buying a mat bar.
100%.
I'll put it that way so they don't get mad, hopefully. Because they didn't start in a trophy truck.
No.
They worked their way up to it. The problem is, in our industry, the motherfucker starts with a car that does 100 and essentially can do 80 through a whoop section. And
he might be coming out of a Camry. Like, the last driving experience he had was like,
yeah,
a Sienna or, you know, something. But you can stuff him in, like you say, these super built machines.
Right. So as we keep going down the path of, they get closer and closer and closer to what a, it's more so now the point of, instead of being limited by the car, you're now limited by your driving skill.
Right.
Like, if you put everybody in an 800 and put them on a freaking, you know, say kind of a short course, your best driver and your middle of the pack are probably going to be, what, a little bit different seconds and laps?
Yeah.
They all have the pedal to the floor. None of them are scared of dying. Like,
it's all Miatas at that point. It's something you can just pin it.
Right. And that's the problem now, is you've got a car where you take, you know, one of our local racers and put them in that Mav-R, whatever their car of choice is, doesn't matter. You put them in it, and then you go grab the guy who drove his buddy side-by-side one time. Now he's buying one from the dealership.
Yeah.
Like, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
So now that they're at that race capability almost from square one, it's like, okay, well, what's required in desert racing? An A-plus pillar.
Yep.
A thicker cage. All of this stuff. And it's like, okay, so now I've got to the point where I try and sell people on the A-pluses that weld from here to the chassis.
Yeah. I should have left it on this one, but I don't know why. When they did it, I was like, I don't know. I don't want that. But you guys worked with me on it, so.
Right. And, I mean, they're still, like we say, way stronger than stock. The grab handle definitely helps gusset this bend. That's why it went from being a add-on to standard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you see it as a paid-for option on my website, let me know. I think I fixed it. But if you're ordering our cage, you get grab handles whether you like it or not. If you don't want them, I put up a fight. Why do you not want them?
Actually.
Yeah. Why do you not want them? I want them there. So I'm like, yeah, sure. Cost me less money to build it. I make more money, but I want it there. But ultimately, and that's kind of like why I won't say I pushed Royce into doing it with his new car, but
you're talking about the super fast gauge.
Yeah.
That thing is sick.
Right. I'm like, put the A plus on that thing. Like, his car goes to a lot of shows. I'm like, I want this to become maybe not standard in our world, but I don't want it to be looked on anymore as a, I don't race, I don't need that. Yeah, but you're still going to go to Sand Hollow and do 80.
Dude, you're calling me out, man. That's exactly what I did. I was like, I'm not racing. It's fine. Like, right. That's for Michael Lee. He can have that stuff right on there.
Right, but, yeah, those guys that are super pushing the limits.
Yeah. You just call me out right here in the middle of this. It's fine. I get it.
No, but I mean, we still sell probably, I doubt 9 out of 10 cages have them. But I'm like, think about it too, you know, from a customer aspect in the long run. Like, you do wad your car up one time, as heavy as they are, as fast as they are, good chances you're going to need to replace your cage now. If they take a blow right here versus the back or side, it's going to do a little bit of damage if you're doing 40, 50 miles an hour. So save yourself the money and the time of, you know, having to buy a new cage or wondering, you know, how many more times can I roll this before the structural integrity of it's gone. So, and I mean, I'll say between dunes and rock crawling, we get the most carnage. Like, surprisingly, it's not those guys like Michael Lee or, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. Sometimes when they wreck, it's really harsh, but those guys are practicing and putting so many miles on cars to get to their skill level. Most of the time, they don't need them.
Yeah.
It's the guy that goes
a different breed. It's, yeah. Like, it's their thing that they do.
But they understand it. It's the guy that goes to Glamis with the Pro R that goes, hey, bro, I'm going to jump this 100 foot at 80 miles an hour and then cartwheels 7 times.
Yeah, he's the dude that's not going to get shown up by the kid right on the YZ125.
Right, right.
And exactly. Then he just owns his car.
It's definitely, as the industry progresses with more capable cars, the safety aspect keeps getting more intense. And it sucks because, like, at the same time, like, I look back to the Turbo S days and I go, I miss that. Like, don't get me wrong, they had their issues, but for the average guy, like, you can dune them, you can rock crawl them really well, you can go ride trails really well. They did everything good.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, I look at a Pro R and I go, eh, not the greatest rock crawling car.
No, they're long.
Right. Super fun in the dune, super fun drag race car, probably the best drag race car now. If you're willing to put some money into a turbo kit. But I'm like, you know, the Pro R is kind of inconvenient for the back east guy who's riding in tight trails. Like,
mm-hmm,
you put aftermarket wheels with offset on them, like, they're 80 inches plus wide. Yeah. So, but back then with the Turbo S's, we had lighter cars. They weren't quite as fast. They were cheaper, easier to modify. Like, your average guy did half his work in his garage.
Yep.
Now you start looking at the front ends of these and K&Ms, and you're like, it's not just two bolts to take a control arm off now. And, you know, the ball stud on the hub side.
Yeah, so, no, it's a bit more intense at this point.
Yeah, it's sweet that we have the ability to drive such amazing cars, but it's also hard from the industry aspect point of, okay, yeah, the guy might go buy the car for 40 grand, but, like, if you called me and say, I'm going to push the limits in my car, what should I put on this for a roll cage? Between powder coat, windshield, A plus is on a 4-seater, you're probably 5 grand.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous amount of money to spend.
It's a lot cheaper than Lifelite. Right.
Oh, it's way cheaper. But still, it's like the dude just went out, bought the car. He's probably going to want wheels and tires.
Yeah.
And then he's going to want to go the route of the cage. And he's thinking, well, shit, I went on your website and your cage raw was $2,500 or whatever. And now you're telling me I need spend double that. So as the understanding comes with it, like, a lot of guys call us now and they just ask for the stuff. I want A pluses, I want window nets, I want, you know, maybe I do want to go to Chromoly or whatever it is. But you also have your guys that are newer to it and they're like, well, shit, I thought I was buying a damn near ready to race desert car.
Yeah. They thought they were buying that trophy truck that we were talking about.
Right.
They were getting into it like, this is ready to roll. And it's just not the case.
No. I mean, for your average guy who wants to take their family out and cruise the dunes and stuff, they're not pushing it. They're fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't take away from Polaris and most of those cars can handle a decent roll one time.
Yeah.
But a bad roll, we've seen a lot of bad failures. It's just not really worth putting the family through that.
No.
Or yourself. Sure. So, yeah.
Cool, man. Well, hey, thanks for coming out. This has been awesome. I've learned a lot.
Absolutely.
Where can people check you out? Voodoo?
Yeah, on Instagram, it's Voodoo, VOODOO.RR. I'm horrible with Facebook. I don't even post on there hardly unless we can share it from Instagram. I believe it's Voodoo Riders on Facebook. Our website is VoodooRR.com. We're pretty easy to find on Google, where our addresses, phone numbers, emails, all that stuff. We don't try and hide. But yeah, like I say, we're pretty available. We're not open on weekends. There's been a lot of thought put into that just to make the ease for the customers of picking up on days they're not working, but I have not put that into effect yet. So we'll see how that goes.
Cool, man. Thanks again. This has been awesome.
Hell yeah. Absolutely.